Satipatti, Aryadeva, Sunyate, Buddhesaha.
Then the Bhagavan arose from that concentration and commended the Bodhisattva, Mahasattva, Arya, Avalokiteshvara, saying,
Well said, son of lineage. It is like that.
Once you practice the
profound perfection of wisdom,
which is serenity, you need to stop these words. The Bhagavan having been stolen, the Bodhisattva,
Avalokiteshvara, Mahasattva, Mahasattva, Arya, Avalokiteshvara,
those surrounding their
entirely along and Kandanas, all enjoyed and highly praised that spoken by the Bhagavan. My voice is a little soft tonight, but is it okay? The speakers have been. It's okay to cough. Temple practice is rarely silent. You know, we do some silent sitting, but in our tradition, when we get together, it's generally we're going to be doing a ceremony together, talking or listening to a talk. So the emphasis is not on silence, it's on community, receiving the teachings, dialogue, and so forth. So in temples, it's a gathering place. It's not a retreat center. Also, it's not a monastery. living in a monastery, as I've done, is very different. In a monastery, you're there, right? There's nowhere else to go. The Lojong practices that we've been talking about and teaching the mind training that has to do with generating bodhicitta and learning to let go of our fixed standpoint is put into place automatically in a monastic situation because you can't avoid people. So since we're not all living together, we have to do a lot of things together, so a temple has to be very active. We have to do a lot of projects so that we're like potatoes in a big bowl, a big tub. One of my teachers says that Sangha is like potatoes in a tub. When you rub them together, they get clean. Has anybody ever tried that, throwing potatoes in a big tub and you rub them against each other? Yeah. You know, individually scrubbing the potato takes too long. You get a big thing like this and put them all in together. He said American style practice is you take the potato out and you do that with a little scrub brush, but in Asia, I don't know, is that true? Has anybody seen that in Asia? They put the, maybe it was just a story, but I've seen them do it. Okay, good. Okay, that's like that, yeah. Or sometimes my teacher would compare the Sangha, the people that come together to practice, like the stones that, you know, semi-precious stones or, you know, kind of interesting rocks you put in a tumbler and they roll around until they become smooth and polished, like that. Those metaphors felt very real when I've lived in monasteries. I've lived in both Zen and Tibetan monasteries. So there's a lot of opportunity. So tonight, I'm hoping new people interact with people so you have an opportunity to rub off some of the rough edges, if there are any. If there are not any rough edges, then we just keep polishing, right? We need each other. You can't polish without another rock, right? So, this weekend, we're going to have a meditation workshop from 8 o'clock to 3 o'clock, and then some time afterwards for individual interviews, short ones. So we're calling it a workshop, not a retreat, right? Yeah. I like the workshop because the workshop's about asking questions and dialogue and silent while we're sitting, but otherwise I want people to interact. Even in some retreats, there's interaction. But in our tradition, if somebody really wants a silent retreat, they're actually going to go off on their own. They're going to be in their own cell, maybe in a retreat center, or they'll be out in the woods in their own cave or tent or something. So the real silent retreats, sometimes with others, but lots of times alone. It's different when you do an alone retreat, even for a weekend, right? No one's watching. My first teacher, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, said, the real practice is what you do when no one's looking. And then maybe later this year we can do like a group retreat. And a group retreat should be done, it can be done here, but you know, it's best when it's overnight in a kind of quiet setting where you've driven a little bit of a ways and you have to think twice before leaving, right? In long retreats that I've done, maybe for months. It was the first week, and we would just do maybe a few days, but I always want someone to arrive saying, something's happened and you have to leave immediately. So it's good to do a country retreat because on the way up there we can drive and get the right motivation, and then while we're there, it actually is very quiet. City retreats have some value, of course. Sometimes people come and go in city retreats, but it's really hard to do a day-long retreat and then go home and do everything and then come again the next day, don't you think? We do it, and we will do it here, but I'll say I'm looking forward to doing at least a weekend or two overnights, you know, arrive Friday night and then kind of settle in, and then get up early Saturday, and then Saturday night, and then leave Sunday afternoon. How many people would like to do one like that? All right. You're in. It's doable. So, to work up to things properly, what I like to see is the best thing is when people have a practice, they come here, so they're having some like regular practice like this, and then they do, you know, some of the Saturday workshops, and then you do a group retreat, and then you do a solo retreat like that. So you work up to it. That makes sense, right? And hopefully by the time you've done a few workshops and you've done some sitting practice here, you've also evolved a some kind of regular at-home practice, some kind of daily practice. That makes sense, right? Because when you go to the top of the mountain, you have to also come down the mountain. The metaphor meaning, if you think you're going to have some breakthrough or some profound experience in a retreat, which definitely can happen, you have to have a way to reintegrate that into the world. So if you don't have a daily practice or at least a sangha or a temple, it can become really a difficult experience. There's a style of meditation where they have like 10-day retreats. I know they have one in North Fork, California, by Yosemite. Actually, I used to live there. They do 10-day Vipassana retreats. Completely silent, and you can't move. It's mostly a body scan, and there's some value in that, but lots of times it just becomes I did it kind of thing, you know, where I endured it. But I've never met anybody, and I'm interested in contrary evidence, but I've never met anybody that then had a really daily practice after that. It'd be like, well, I climbed Everest, and now I'm just walking around McKinley Park, you know. So the idea of doing a retreat is to deepen our practice, but also to come back to a continuity of practice. And then you kind of work it up again and deepen it. And then, I mean, each time when I say come back, it's not like you're going down, you're loosening your deepness, but it has to have a regular sitting practice afterwards. And that, I don't know now, but it's probably the same as a lot of people. Some people in the United States have done like 3-year retreats, 3-year supervised retreats with qualified teachers, which is fantastic. But then there's not any provision for what they do when they get out. Because, of course, the idea that, well, by the time we get out, we'll have achieved some realization or nirvana or something, so it won't matter, right? Well, guess what? It does. So everybody I know that's gone on long retreats, you still are like, well, what do I do now, right? So even when we have I don't know, maybe at some point we'll have very long retreats. Maybe at some point there'll be the possibility that people would even want to do that, which is fantastic. But you need a temple, you need a sangha to come back to. At least somebody will give you some place to stay, right? You can't live in retreat the whole time. Sometimes people go on long retreats and they think, well, I'll come back and be a teacher, because I'll have, maybe in some traditions, you know, they call me Lama, or they'll call you Lama after a 3-year retreat. But teaching is very, 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 very different than being on retreat. You can imagine, right? on retreat, even if you're doing a group retreat, everyone follows the rules and pretty much people are quiet. Of course, there are arguments on retreat. It's not always a nirvana, but coming back and trying to have a teaching career is very, very different. So even after a workshop, a day long, I don't know if I'm teaching the next Monday after that. I don't think so. But you want to go back to a routine so that your baseline is just your daily practice, your daily life. It's really interesting to go on a retreat where we think we've made some vast progress, and then we come back and no one sees anything different, right? So I think I may be the only one that is kind of Zen koan, not exactly, but what I'm fond of asking people is, you know, what if you got enlightened and no one, you know, noticed? Would that be okay? Of course, we have to check ourselves, you know? Don't we really, on some level, want people to recognize, like, oh, you look really different, or there's a glow in your eye or something, right? But, of course, that's very possible, but when you come back, you just want to come back to a sense of ordinary life. It should seem easy, but it's not. Logically, you know, when you think about, well, I'll just be more aware in ordinary life, but maybe even people in this room, after a few people have done maybe several weeks retreat, you think I don't know, maybe it's just me, but like after a long retreat, even you just doing a mindful retreat, driving should be easier, right? It's not. Anybody had that experience where, well, why is that? Okay, you think like, well, it should be Zen in the art of driving, and I should be, you know, some great race car driver, but it's different, isn't it? Yeah. You do? Okay. Well, yeah. So that's an interesting phenomena. That would be one of these PhD dissertations for somebody like Rick Hansen, or you know those the neuro-Buddhist types, right? Because it's certainly, on a one level, we're becoming more mindful and aware, but when we're working with heavy machinery, there seems to be something off, right? So this shows that something different, you know, our idea of mindfulness or ordinary reality is largely conceptual. That what we think is happening, mindfulness, first of all, where we're getting just better at doing everything, is maybe not what real mindfulness is. Because there's the presumption, not only in realization, that your life will get easier afterwards, but that in mindfulness, if you just do a mindfulness retreat, that you'll become more kind of mindful or precise, right? Am I making sense? I don't know. Well, maybe you found out already, but people have this idea that if they do the Dharma practice or they gain some realizations, life gets easier. No, you get a better set of problems. Okay. So you get bodhisattva problems, right? So after long retreats, it's good to have kind of ordinary life to re-enter to, but even after short retreats of a week or less, we're not coming back to what we think is we're not becoming mindful with the way we usually think of it. So even with the workshop, you know, like if you say, okay, well, it's over at 3, and maybe I'll stay for an interview. Maybe in a short workshop, nothing will happen, but, you know, don't tell your family or friends, you know, I'll be back at 3:15. You don't want to immediately, you know, get in and jump in the car and roar off. Go around and straighten out the chairs and have some dialogue with some people. And also notice what happens as you're getting back to what we see as a more normal kind of consciousness. So the purpose of this talk a little bit is to point out what we think of as enlightened consciousness is usually just concept. And then what we think of as ordinary mind, but just becoming more mindful, that's also concept. Both realization and real mindfulness are vastly different than what our imagination is. Even in beginning mindfulness, what's happened was we're dropping off, so to speak, our normal sense of self. Which means it's going to be hard to drive a car, right? And in the deep retreat, we may drop off, you know, temporarily, not only our normal sense of self, but our normal sense of what we think the world is. So in both cases, you want to have a return to the conventional world that's a soft landing. Not a mind. You want to notice, like, oh, what's my post-meditation experience like? So when you're home, if you do even like a 25-minute meditation, you decide, okay, now's the ending time. You ring a bell, or your phone has a Tibetan bell on it, or something. You know, just sit there for another minute. Don't immediately jump up. My own teacher said, you won't have a lover or stay married very long if you jump up right away after making love, right? So don't jump up after meditation, right? You know, just kind of sit there for a second. We want to train to notice the gaps that happen between our normal, you know, ego self-consciousness and our no self-consciousness, to use that word. We want to notice the difference. We want to create some kind of transition and gap there. Not too much that people get disoriented or wacky or arrogant or something, but you want to notice you know, that switch happening. If we're in a state of awareness, but we're not noticing how we got there, we won't be able to really utilize it or help others. So a lot of people think, well, I'll get realized in the retreat, or I'll get realization while sitting on the cushion, which can happen, but what usually we're looking for is you start noticing the switch. You start noticing the gap. You start noticing how ordinary mind, conventional mind, conventional self-conscious mind forms. That's easy, right? No, it's difficult. it's difficult. Because usually we just kind of think, well, I'm sitting here and my sense of self, this is the way it's always been, right? Feels that way now, doesn't it? Like, we're just like, there were me, and it's just me, right? And that's, we don't know when we started feeling this way. Do you? I don't. You just look, there's just me. But it's a creation. And it won't help to do years of psychotherapy and try to figure out when did you first become me. You know? Was it when, you know, you popped out or something? No. You know, it feels like the me is eternal, doesn't it? Doesn't feel like it has really a beginning or necessarily an end. Maybe you think, well, we'll die, but it doesn't, that sense of self we have feels kind of just like it's just been there, you know, because it's there. So we want to create situations like sittings here and talks and books and retreats so that we start noticing how our sense of self can fall apart or be deconstructed, and how then it rebuilds itself. How we reform our sense of conventional self, and then once again how we notice the conventional self is deconstructed and a different kind of consciousness becomes center. This is the real thing, you know. So it isn't just that you want to say, oh, I just want to be selfless and have no, you know, I just want to realize Buddha nature and all is gone, and or that's all I have to do. We have to see how the conventional self appears and disappears, how the like Buddha nature self is, you know, a stream of consciousness. We have to see how it actually works. So we're training here at Lion's Roar to really be professional, professional body-mind people. You want to see really how your body and mind appear and disappear, how your self is formed and how it can be dissolved. And then you'll be in tune with basic life rhythm, and it feels great. So it's not a one-way trip to enlightenment, and then you just kind of stay there. Enlightenment being just dwelling in a state of cosmic Buddha land or something. It's a constant flux between conventional and absolute self. Conventional truth and absolute truth. And then the two working together, sometimes we call ultimate truth. Terms become interesting, don't they? But I want people to train to this. This is really doing the highest yoga training, doing the correct Mahamudra and Dzogchen training. Because we can't leave you in retreat the whole time, right? And we can't leave you in conventional reality either. You have to learn how to live in both worlds, right? How to surrender your fixed position, and sometimes how to take up a fixed position, how to surrender your limited self, have an absolute self, but also sometimes you have to be the person on the driver's license. Isn't that so? Social Security and the DMV wants your conventional self, right? You can't go in and say, unless you change your name, you don't want to give your refuge name and say you're essentially a Buddha, you know, but they might not give you a driver's license. So we want to be masters of both worlds. We want to be the master of the absolute world, and then the master of the conventional world, and then that's the, you know, ultimate master, right? You want to be Mahasiddha. Completely great, accomplished, adept, right? So that's what we're after. And then finally, when we perfect or bring it fully to fruition, where we can then generate the desire to help others, then that's called Buddha, right? You're fully awake. That's easy, right? That's cool. Huh? Yeah. Okay, so the reason I say it's easy because Dharma is easy, samsara is not easy. Being in tune with absolute and conventional, the rhythm of life is easy. When you're out of balance and out of tune, then you suffer, and that's hard. That makes sense, right? Okay. So yeah, I say it's easy. Of course, it takes study and work. Yeah, of course. But you can master Dharma, you cannot master samsara. Okay? There's no mastery in samsara. Okay. Maybe time for a few questions, comments, or complaints. Yes, hi. It gets created, but once we have it, it seems like it's always been there. You know, and it's really hard, like, assuming we all feel like adults, I mean, it might be hard to say, like, when did you actually just start feeling that way? But once we have a fully formed self-consciousness, you know, conventional belief in self, it just feels like it's always been there. Yeah, I think it's actually kind of painful, yeah. Definitely. The formation is definitely painful. And it's painful letting go, too. But it's still easier than samsara. Yeah, good question. So in Monday night talks or sometimes Sunday, you know, most of the time Dharma teachers and, you know, in the West, of course, and even in Asia, are basically going to give you know, talks that are addressed to get you to continue to practice and be a good person, you know, which is important, right? But I know, seeing everyone here, I don't have to tell you, like, to be good. You know, everyone's a nice person. I don't have to say, you know, don't harm yourself, you know, be gentle, be care about animals and plants and the universe. Everyone's already there, right? I don't have to give a moral lecture, right? Traditionally in Tibet, a lama starting out would have to give a moral lecture, like, don't harm things and try to be a good person, right? And that would be expected. And it kind of carries on in a more subtle way. But if it just falls into, I just want to be a good person practicing meditation and I don't really want to know the nature of mind, I don't really want to wake up to, you know, ultimate nature of things, I don't want to be really a Buddha, then you're not fulfilling what's possible in the tradition. Because also, you'd have to kind of redact some of the prayers, you know. Because you said these prayers and said, I'll become a Buddha to save all beings, right? I know some people won't say it. Did everyone say it in the room, right? Well, we all did the prayers, right? Yeah. So having a motivation of wanting to be good is not harming and just be a decent person, of course. But we're making full pledge that we want to completely wake up and see how things actually work. Not only to help others, but help ourselves. You can't help others if you doesn't know how it works. So that's a professional approach. That's easy, right? Yeah. It's easier than not knowing how it works, because nothing's more horrible than when we're confronted with a difficult situation, life and death situation, and you know we don't know what to do or how it works, right? It's a really horrible feeling when we're trying to help others or help ourselves and we feel completely stuck or stymied. When people are dying, when people are sick, when people are going crazy, it's hard, like, I don't know what to do. When the wrong person gets elected, whatever your politicals are, then we don't know what to do. You know, we're kind of out to sea. But with Dharma, we actually know how things work on the fundamental basis. So there isn't that sense of confusion. And it feels good. So it's easier. Yep. So we take a short stretch and 5-minute stretch and then do a meditation. What do you think? It's probably easier to stretch. It's better to have a little stretch than your, you know. Yeah. And then we'll ring the bell or the gong and then we'll be okay. Yeah. La la la. Just letting go lots of times doesn't have enough structure for it. Structure for beginners. Letting go is something that, you know, you actually say at the very end, in a way, not at the very beginning. After you've completed the meal, then you can say, let go. But in the beginning, I suggest for tonight, just experiment. Just let your thoughts kind of ride out on your out-breath. And then on the in-breath, you don't have to think anything. So let them ride out like they're riding out into space. So we're not really letting them go as much as we're letting them ride out, supported by the breath. So breath supports thoughts. So think on your out-breath, and you don't have to think on your in-breath. We know how to breathe in, right? So you don't have to think about it, like, you know, just do it. And in advanced meditation a little bit, it's easier to keep thoughts and sentences to no more than 6 or 7 words or syllables. That's why the Mani mantra, 6-syllable, is so nice, because it usually conforms to the length of our out-breath. Om Mani Padme Hum, you know. Sometimes Om Mani Padme Hum Hri, you know. If your thoughts are longer than your out-breath, your mind will try to catch up, and we'll try to speed up, or you'll try to speed up your breathing, and that's why people get into this like trying to catch their tail kind of experience and sitting. So if you can't think of a sentence that's 6 or 7 words, just do the Mani mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. Or you could think, I really love Lion's Roar a lot. Pick a positive sentence that you know, no more than 6 or 7 words. And then when you're out, your out breath will be enough to support the sentence, you see. It's easy. You can do it. And then when you breathe in, you don't have to think about anything. And then the thought goes in the out breath. But if you have more than one thought, that can still, they can go out together. You don't have to hold on to them. It's okay. Make sense? You want to try it? Okay.